Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into our 25th anniversary. We're going to be giving away these Maryland Lottery scratch-offs. We had a $100 winner a couple weeks ago at Coco's. We're going to be at Pappas, and not the Pappas in Cockeysville where I've been going, or the Pappas in Parkville where I've been, or the Pappas in Bel Air that we began and opened. We're going to be at the Pappas in Glen Burnie later on in the month. We're going to be down there with Anne Arundel County Executive Stuart Pittman. I hope everybody stops by, says hello, have a delicious crab cake on the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. That will be on the 29th of the month. Also have some other great guests joining us. That's a Tuesday. It's also brought to you by our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. We're into the summer months. I'm celebrating the one-year anniversary of my new windows at WNST, and we love the windows and highly recommend our friends at Window Nation. This guy joined me, I don't know, about a year or two ago. He's an author and a baseball historian. He has lots and lots of links to the south side of Chicago, Illinois. And I, you know, still go there and get a pizza from time to time. My last name's on the wall at the Comiskey. So I love that part of it. David Fletcher's not only a doctor, he's also a baseball historian and author. Really when it comes to the history of the game, David, I had you on talking about the Dick Allen and the South Side of Chicago and maybe a little bit of Phillies and why he's not in the Hall of Fame. You did a book on that. And then there's the even older history, and there's been a lot of that going on around here, is that we dive into, I've done things on Negro League history in the last month out in Kansas City, but this is a Black Sox scandal sort of more than 100 years later now, and unearthing facts and stories and going back and looking at the history of baseball. Dave, it's great to have you on. I'm glad guys like you and Ken Burns are out there digging this stuff up to give us interesting stuff to read.
Thank you so much. I see the Aparicio name on the wall when I'm out there at the ballpark. So you should be proud of your family's legacy.
Well, it's the reason I'm in America. So, I beat long and hard all the immigration stuff here the last couple of years. Just as an aside, I came this close. I'm on the internet right now and the jersey's a little too big for me, but I've been in like sort of retro mode lately, and I found this 69 White Sox Aparicio gray with the pinstripe blue and the white lettering that was on the 1970 baseball cards episode, and I'm this close to picking up the number 11 and putting it on. It's a little wool, so it's a little bit more of a winter feel to me, but I love the history of baseball and things that remind us of the history of baseball. And listen, I mean, whether it's steroids, and I was in those locker rooms as a nationally syndicated host back in the turn of the century where Andrew Steen, Dione, and Sammy Sosa is now Caucasian. I mean, baseball history writes itself differently. But 100 years later, this Black Sox scandal is sort of the scandal that all others are held up to in sports. And now that we get into wagering and we talk about all this Big Poppy with the hose and betting and all of this stuff that's going on now, it makes me shudder for where the history of sport has been for scandal. And I guess I'll let you pick this up because this is your story and your book has nothing to do with this year's White Sox or the Dylan Cease or the Orioles lease. This is old school and you have to have a real passion, Dr. Fletcher, to want to take a deep dive. Tell everybody about the thesis of what you're after in this, because I've been up to Cooperstown, and this is something that baseball and people in baseball, much like the steroid scandal, would rather not talk about or have people write books about.
Well, the book that my co-editor, Jacob Homrecki, who's the editor of Saber, and I put out is about the Joe Jackson 1924 trial, where he sued Charles Comiskey for his back pay. It was the 100th anniversary is next year. It's the final centennial celebration of the Black Sox scandal. And what we published, only about 10 people in the world had ever seen before. We published a 658-page transcript, which is 330,000 words, of the actual testimony given in this trial in Milwaukee almost 100 years ago. And it's a fascinating read. You'll never see it again because the owner of baseball exposes his finances. And then you have the most iconic, accomplished player of his time, who's banned for baseball forever, testifying at that trial. And it's a fabulous read. It reads like a movie script. And the sad thing is, I'm going to give a spoiler alert to your audience, but at the end, Joe Jackson is thrown in jail at the end of the trial. He's thrown in jail because he committed perjury. He, his testimony that he gave before the 1920 grand jury in Chicago was read back to him, and he gave different answers. And so because of that change in his responses to questions, the judge threw out the verdict, which was in favor of Joe Jackson getting around $16,000 back pay, and held him for perjury.
Give me in a thumbnail, pretend I'm your grandson and say, who is Shoeless Joe? What are black socks? I heard of White Sox and Red Sox. Like, take me back to that time. Now, my father was born in 1919. I do not know a lot about this scandal other than it was scandalous, right? I mean, it's like knowing about the Great Potato Famine. You hear about it, but you don't read about it. You don't, you know, unless you know about it or have a movie. I mean, I knew the Titanic sunk. I didn't know the story till I saw the movie. In regard to that period of time, I'm thinking corruption, prohibition, baseball's the biggest thing going, right? Like Babe Ruth, friggin' Babe Ruth at this time, right? And we're getting out of a world war, right? I mean, we're about to go into the roaring 20s. Tell me about baseball then, and why Shoeless Joe Jackson's even someone that I've heard of.
Well, baseball was hurt by World War One. It almost didn't play the 1918 season. They ended up having a shortened season. The season ended that year in September, early September of 1918. That's when the Chicago Cubs won the National League pennant, but they played the World Series at Comiskey Park against the Red Sox. It's believed that that series was fixed as well, as the Cubs took money to lose that World Series to the Red Sox. And in fact, that was the idea for Eddie Seacott, one of the White Sox pitchers, to pitch to gamblers about that his teammates could be had if he would pay them money to lose the World Series. So coming
how
out,
how much money were they making, and how much money was the bribe? I mean, I and again, all of this sounds like funny money. When you say $100, you like you do that for $100 was, you know, probably 10 weeks pay for a lot of people in this country at that time, right?
You're correct. I mean, the ball players' salaries were low, but they were still bigger than everyday Americans. Joe Jackson in 1919 was making $6,000, even though he was with a premier player. Eddie Collins, who's second baseman, was making $15,000. He was one of the highest paid players in baseball at that time. But they had small salaries, and so they were being offered $20,000 a piece to roll on the World Series, which was a sizable amount of money. And Eddie Seacott, who was the ringleader along with Chick Gandel, he ended up using his money to pay off his mortgage for a farm in Detroit. It was all motivation by greed.
Okay, and so they lost. They threw the World Series. They got paid by the mobsters, right? That all this happened, right? How did they get caught?
Well, how they got caught was that it was pretty well known that even before the World Series had started, that something was going on. The betting odds had changed. The White Sox 1919 team was very dominant. They had won the World Series in 1917. 1918, a lot of the players, including Joe Jackson, served in the naval shipyards rather than military service. So their team was decimated in 1918. 1919, they're a fabulous team. And they won the World Series, won the American League pennant to play the Reds in the World Series. And the betting odds suddenly changed before the World Series is because it was not a very well-kept secret. And the problem was, is there were multiple gamblers who were involved. Everybody thinks of a guy named Arnold Rothstein was involved, but he really wasn't directly involved. And so you just had a lot of, rumors swirling around and, people didn't keep their mouth shut. And so it was kept under the hat until about September of 1920. The World Series ended October 9th, 1919. The White Sox lost game 8. So the series was a 9-game series. So they lost 5-3 games. there was reports in a local horse racing publication called Collier's Eye that did name names right after the World Series, saying what players had been reached, what kind of money they gotten, where the payoff was. But that publication was ignored because it wasn't mainstream. And baseball did their best to keep this buried, to not bring the scandal to light. And it didn't come to light until late 1920 season when William Veeck Sr., who was the president of the Cubs, brought the attention of a fix that was being done between the Cubs and a Phillies game. And that started a grand jury investigation about baseball and gambling. And because of that grand jury that was convened in Chicago, that led to the exposure of the players who were involved in the Black Sox scandal. The first person to actually testify was Eddie Seacott, and then it was Joe Jackson. This is on September 28th, 1920. And the final day was Lefty Williams. Those three actually testified before a grand jury and admitted that they took money for this participation in the plot.
You know, it's interesting. I think Chicago, 1919, 1920, 1921, you know, first thing that comes is Capone, right? And I'm like, I wonder if, yeah, I mean, Capone was right there, right? Like, and I think about Chicago being mobbed up at that period of time and how ball players would be a target for this. This book that you've put forth and this tomb of information from this trial that it got to this point, tell me what Shoeless Joe was looking for in regard to money after the fact of his guilt, right? I mean, he was guilty, right?
He was guilty. He took the money. There's no doubt about that. He took the money and actually talks about his wife testifies as well. What they spent the money on was his Joe Jackson's sister's medical bills, ironically.
Wow. Okay.
He's
known as this bandit person, but he was not an awful human, right? He was not.
He
was a great baseball player, right?
Well, he's third best batting average of all time, .356. So, I mean, I think it speaks for itself.
He would be spoken of like Babe Ruth and like Lou Gehrig in not a purgative way had he just been a ball player on the back of his bubblegum, his Gowdy card.
That's correct. You know, he still had several years ahead of him with his career. I mean, he was one of the best players, natural swing. Babe Ruth said he copied his swing off of Joe Jackson's swing. But he basically got caught up in this. He was somewhat used. He wasn't a ringleader in the fix of the eight players. They needed his name. When he confessed, he always said he played to win, but he did tell the grand jury's judge, Charles McDonald, who did testify in his trial and as in this book, they didn't always play his hardest, during the World Series, but he had a fabulous World Series. Batted 375, was the best average in the series, had the only home run in the World Series.
So he wasn't tanking.
Well, statistically, he wasn't tanking. In fact, what's interesting about how the case is laid out is they have expert witnesses, which are AP reporters, talk about his play, and they did not see anything was suspicious. Obviously, he testified he did not do anything to take away his team's ability to win. So that was
how did they lose? How did they throw it?
Well,
I mean, how do you throw a 9-game series?
Well, how you throw a 9-game World Series is, you know, two of the players they had were their pitching staff. And so that one of the problems, again, you talk about, you know, World War One, the times, just like now we're coming out of a pandemic. In 1919, we're coming out of the pandemic of the Spanish flu in 1918-1919. And the star pitcher, Red Faber, who won three World Series games against New York Giants in 1917, had gotten flu in the Navy. And he was somewhat debilitated. He could not pitch because of his medical issues in the 1919 World Series. Or the White Sox would have obviously won the series if they had Red Faber in their pitching staff. So basically, Eddie Seacott was a first game pitcher. It was a signal that he was to walk the first batter. He actually hit the first batter. That was sort of the signal to the gangsters that were involved in this that the fix was on. And he basically, there was some wildness of his pitching. There was a couple of plays that he misplayed. It's not obvious. It's subtle. In fact, there's actually film that came out a few years ago. It actually shows one of the famous plays in 1919, the first game, where you really question about, was this deliberate or not? So basically the pitching, and they didn't have anything on the ball. The catcher, Ray Schalk, who's in the Hall of Fame for the White Sox catcher, he got, in the face of Eddie Seacott the first game. Second game, Lefty Williams, he has had one inning where he walked a lot of batters.
Some of these guys weren't in on it.
Yeah, right? I mean, you only had eight players that were in on it.
And the other guys had no idea that it happened. Literally, they were pissed they lost the World Series, and he probably more pissed that their teammates took all this money.
Yes,
they're ready to roll on their teammates at that point, right?
They were kind of, the bunch was called the Clean Sox. And so they
obviously... I'm learning, by the way. If you just tuned in, David Fletcher's here. I just want to promote the book. I love learning because I don't really know these stories. Joe Jackson, plaintiff v. Chicago American League Ball Club defendant, the never seen before trial transcript from this 1924 courtroom trial against the Chicago White Sox and team owner Charles Comiskey in the aftermath of the infamous Black Sox scandal. So I'm just trying to put the movie together as best I can, Dave.
Well, that's understandable. I mean, it's a very complex story, but it's a basic story of greed and American heroes that, become somewhat tainted. The whole story of The Natural was sort of fashioned after the Joe Jackson character of being tainted by gangsters. And so, sort of like a Robert Redford-esque type of situation. So it's a fascinating story. The other pitcher, Lefty Williams, he lost three games in the World Series, including the eighth game where he was allegedly threatened before the game if he didn't lose it. Because the White Sox were coming back. They won game 6 and 7. And
gangsters were getting nervous, huh?
People were getting nervous because they were coming back. And so that was sort of the pressure on some of the participants in the fix, because the testimony of the players was that they stopped trying to lose after game two. And so credibly, the only evidence is that the White Sox players who were involved only deliberately lost game 1, 2, and 8. And so it was going to be very interesting if there had been a game 9. There was going to be a game 9 in Cincinnati. And Dickey Kerr, who won game 3, pitched one of the best World Series performances ever in winning game 3, was going to pitch game 9. So a lot of fascination is, the series did not have any off days. They traveled between the trains and between Cincinnati and Chicago. And it was a different era. And so this is, inside story about this big scandal. And I think the big thing about it is it really exposes the front office of the White Sox. Comiskey testifies, Harry Grabner, his trusted secretary, general manager, testifies, and even Alfred Austrian, who I call the Michael Cohen fixer for Charles Comiskey, his lawyer, testifies in the trial. And so it's just a fascinating...
Was Comiskey in on it?
Comiskey was not in at all. Of course not. It was his business. He got decimated. His life was wrecked with this. He always has been blamed for paying low salaries to his players, but actually his salaries were higher than most other American League owners. He was not in on it. He ended up having his franchise pretty much be decimated, even though they made some good attempts later to reboot the franchise after these players got kicked out of baseball. But it was a devastating situation for him. He was a co-founder of the American League. And he had a big feud with the American League president, Ban Johnson, and that had a lot to do with the scandal.
Well, the book is fascinating. It is literally it's word for word transcript, right? I mean, that you went back to this period of time and sort of unearthed this thing as a historian, right?
That's correct. There only been the actual transcript was in the office of the grandson of the lawyer, Raymond Cannon, who represented Joe Jackson at his trial. And I had first seen it in 2003. and a copy was given to Jerome Holtzman, American League, the Major League Baseball historian, and I ended up purchasing it from Jerome Holtzman in 2007. And I just decided it was important to get it out there in the public domain. And so we basically, the actual transcript from the stenographer was almost 1,700 pages.
Wow. And so
we, you know, we...
Double space, baby.
Double space. Oh, yeah. But it we put it, you know, in Word. We made some editorial corrections as far as the content, explaining some people who it was. You know, it's very, very fascinating document. We provide background about it. We list who all the attorneys were, the exhibits, and so forth. And it's just a
great legal piece, right? If you're in law school or you're that person that right. This is, I'm sure it's thick and it's a little
real
antiquated,
thick,
right?
Yeah. Right. Real thick.
Thick and a little bit weirdly antiquated, like in a 100-year-old kind of way, right?
Well, we got another Todd Radom cover. Todd just absolutely just rocks it. You know, he's got this legal-esque cover like this with that.
Todd's been a guest. By the way, Todd came in Baltimore last week and went to the game and didn't call me about a crab cake. So, fooey on you, Todd Radom. Come right, well, on now. He's up in Philadelphia. I'll get him back out here soon.
So, anyway, this is he always does a great job. But, I mean, basically, you know, everyone thinks they know the story about this, you know, about the scandal. And I know I'm educating you, Nelson, but this is the first document out there of all the books on the scandal that really uncovers the truth, is because we actually have the words of Charles Comiskey and Joe Jackson is what they straight from their mouths, what they told the courts. You know, they're under oath and we're making this thing public for the first time ever. And this book changes everything about knowledge about this. And it's especially relevant today because of Major League Baseball's embracement of gambling. That's what's so ironic.
Well, I mean, Pete Rose thinks so, too. David Fletcher is here. You can go check this out. You can find it at Eckhart's Press. That's Eckhartz Press. I'll throw a link up as well about this this story. Last thing, because I need to know this in my audience that doesn't want to Google. How did it end for Shoeless Joe? I mean, I've seen the artifacts and whatnot in Cooperstown. What happened? He went to jail, right?
Well, I went to jail for one night. He got released and he had to come back. He was supposed to then have a trial on his perjury. He never went back to Wisconsin. If he had set foot in Wisconsin, he would have been arrested. And so he stayed out of Wisconsin the rest of his life. And he ended up not getting the money from Comiskey. The jury had awarded him $16,000, didn't get that. And he went back to Savannah, Georgia, and he had a very successful career as a businessman. Even though he was illiterate, he was very smart and he ran several businesses. Even when he was in the White Sox, he ran a very successful pool hall business. The very, very famous quote Jerome Holtzman said about Joe Jackson was he may have been illiterate, couldn't read, but he certainly could count. And he was referring to the fact, you know, he did take the money, you know, which, you know, obviously made him guilty as far as part of the participation.
Baseball and gambling. It's Big Poppy's got the hose out now. All this stuff's going on. Hey, next time I have you on, the next book that you decide to write that's not about Dick Allen or about the – I mean, you really are – sorry, are you working on another project?
I bet you always are. I am. We've got a sequel to Chili Dog coming up called Comiskey Park Demo, The Last Years of the Baseball Palace of the World. It's about the whole 1980s and about – getting a new Comiskey Park, all the background with that, really fascinating story. And it kind of starts off with the disco demolition and the winning ugly team, but basically goes to 1990. And then the triptych third part of the series is about the 91 to 94 White Sox. And I even have a Cubs book coming out.
Well, I mean, from I'll come out, eat some pizza with you. I'll take you to Pequod's. Yeah. Absolutely, man.
We got to get Todd out with this because he's my man that does covers. No one does better baseball illustration art than he does.
You know, he got involved on my Facebook. Somebody brought his name up because I was literally in a bar. I'm at the Emerald Tavern. It's 11 o'clock at night. And I saw Ohtani up and they were wearing the Angels, the Nolan Ryan, Frank Tanana, the way God meant for the Gene Autry meant for them to be with the big A Angels in the out. They had the throwbacks on and I put a picture up and I'm like, who would screw with what Disney person or Artie Moreno would mess with the perfection of the Angels 70s, 80s uniforms? And someone said, well, Todd got involved and I'm like, I love Todd, but there's nothing wrong with that. And then Todd got into my thread about it. So we got all this stuff going. When I tell Todd that I think the 69 White Sox are gray and white and blue, so I'll have him on. And by the way, next time I have him on or you on, I hope to at least be wearing that Aparicio throwback that I've been eyeing up for like 15 years and thinking that would look good on me if I could just get it for like under $200. So I'm trying to find it. But I love the nostalgia, and anytime you want to bring me a little piece of baseball history that gives me a chance to talk about Dick Allen or whatever, I'm all about it, Dave. You and
well,
Todd,
thank you
all
so
of
much. Thank you so much for having me on again. It's a lot of fun.
Well,
take care.
I love talking baseball, and I love talking South Side of Chicago baseball. And I especially love stuff that I don't know the real story. Like, I know Shoeless Joe, I know Black Sox, I know more now than I did 20 minutes ago. You can know more if you invest in Joe Jackson, plaintiff v. Chicago American League Ball Club, defended the never seen before trial transcript, now soon to be 100 years old. We're 25 years old at WNSD. Thank you very much. We're celebrating our anniversary here all week, all month, all year. I'm going to spike the ball, Dave. Next 6 months, we're doing these 25 stories of glory of WNST. It's all presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I'll be giving these away on the 29th of the month at Pappas in Glen Burnie with Stuart Pittman, Anne Arundel County Executive. Also brought to you by our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION, a way to find that. Big celebration at Costas, bigger celebration at Drug City as we go into our 26th year with the Orioles in first place. Pennant race, new starting pitcher in Jack Flaherty, and some great baseball stories ahead. We are WNSD, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.